Well, you know, that's possible. You can
record
on Zoom. In fact, that's one of the places I'm teaching. Everything is recorded. The other place I'm teaching, nothing is recorded. It's just their policy. Very different policies. One of the places I'm teaching will be in person. The other place I'm teaching will be remote. So, well, anyway. So I was saying that last week we're really following the genesis of the positivistic tradition, and I'll redefine that, in a couple of minutes. And that all really starts with Newton. And last week we spent our time talking about Newton, and I read several things from the Principia. And did you get a chance to listen to the recording?
No.
Oh, you didn't? Okay.
I will.
Okay, that's okay. Well, I'm going to recap anyway. And I read from, mainly the preface and the general scolium at the end. And the point is that Newton makes two points that later, I guess you'd say, were generalized into more fundamental philosophical questions. And the point he makes in the preface, which is really explaining the title of the work, Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy, he says, I'm talking about mechanics here. And what is mechanics? Well, it's a branch of physics that deals with the motions of bodies. But what I'm doing, really for the first time, he didn't put it that way, but I'm saying that, what I'm doing is I'm explaining all this mathematically. prior to the Principia, for the most part, we had a couple of predecessors, but Newton really does represent a quantum leap over the past. Prior to that, we had informal observation, we had qualitative explanations and that sort of thing, but not the application of mathematics to the motions of bodies. And that just gives you so much more rigor, it gives you so much more precision than some sort of general qualitative explanation. So anyway, that's what I'm doing, he says, for the science of mechanics for the first time. And then that's the positive little hint that he drops. And then at the end, in the general scolium, there's the negative hint that he drops when he's talking about the possible causes of gravitation. And, can you pass it back to the... And basically says, there aren't any data right now to allow me to theorize as to what gravity really is. And then that famous sentence that is... a lot of people quote, I frame no hypotheses. And by hypothesis, he simply means a speculation of some kind. There aren't any data that allow me to really say something intelligent. Now, we do know, of course, that he thought about it. We know from his letters that he thought about it. But he wasn't going to publish anything as a physicist that at least didn't have some data to support it. Well, you can turn those two sides of Newton, those two hints, as I called them, that he drops, you can turn them into philosophical questions if you simply generalize them. Whereas in the preface, Newton was talking about just the science of mechanics, you can ask the question, well, how about all domains of investigation? Can we specify the criteria that would make any domain of investigation a case of knowledge, as opposed to just guesswork or something like that? That's question number one. And then the negative side, where I frame no hypotheses. Now, probably what Newton thought was that, well, maybe in the future we'll have enough data so that somebody can figure this out, but now we don't. It's probably what he was thinking. But if you want to turn that into a philosophical question, you generalize the now to all time. Are there any questions that we ask that for all time will be impossible to answer? In other words, are there some questions that are simply in principle impossible to answer? Things that we can neither confirm nor disconfirm. And that's how you get from Newton, who's not a philosopher, he's a scientist, but he drops these couple of hints, That's how you get from Newton to the philosophers. And the philosophers, who were considered by positivists to be their sort of great grandparents, are human Kant, and that's where we're going, human Kant. But anyway, at the end of the class, then I said, really what we're talking about here is what came to be known as positivism. And this is really important because it's the direct lineage or the direct ancestor of which pragmatism is really a spin-off, an American spin-off of this positivistic tradition. And I defined positivism, quick and dirty, as follows. I said, anything that can, the two sides again, the positive side and the negative side, anything that can be known scientifically. And then the contrapositive of that, anything that can't be known scientifically cannot be known at all. Right? That's really what positivism is in a nutshell. Now, Tom asked an interesting question at the end of class last time, as the clock was ticking away, and we really didn't have time to pursue it at all. But Tom said, well, gee, isn't that awfully restrictive, you know? And he says, what about ethics? That was your example, you know? I mean, the picture I drew is this circle. And so anything inside the circle is what can be known. But the positivist says, if it can be known, the standards for knowledge are fairly high. It has to be known scientifically. Okay, anything that can't be known scientifically, which means it can't be known at all, would be, you know, somewhere outside the circle. So Tom was saying, well, wouldn't ethics fall outside the circle? And that was the question. And yeah, and really, that question deserves a little more complicated answer than I had like a minute. So it deserves a little more complicated answer than we really had time. But here, it's not even 10 o'clock yet, so we got plenty of time to talk. So the answer is, well, it depends on whom you're talking to. You know, I mean, I guess for any ism, there are lots of sub-isms, right? And so, yeah, put it this way. Some positivists would draw this circle pretty small. And others, such as William James, would
just to give up
draw foreshadowing. We draw it a lot bigger, right? It simply depends on whom you're talking to as to how big that circle is and how much it includes and how much it excludes, right? So let's take the most extreme examples, and these would be the logical positivists of the 1930s. I have to tell you a story. When I was, I think I may have said this before. When I was a junior in college, I heard about and I eagerly procured and read A.J. Ayer's Language, Truth, and Logic. A.J. Ayer was the only English-speaking member of the Vienna Circle. The Vienna Circle was the hotbed of logical positivism during it started in the 20s, probably did in the 30s. I was so taken. Because it's so simple. I mean, everything is just black and white. Everything's just very, very, you know, straightforward. If you read the logical positivist account of it, I was just absolutely swept off my feet by A.J. Ayer's Language, Truth, and Logic. Well, you know, this is just weird how history works, you know. The logical positivists were active, well, the Vienna Circle, obviously, but they were German. And when the Nazis came to power, of course, a lot of people fled Nazi Germany and the environs, you know. And a lot of them wound up here in the U.S. And because so many eminent thinkers, Carnap, for example, was at University of Chicago, came to the U.S., that hugely influenced thought here in the United States. Well, it just turns out the youngest member of the Vienna Circle was a guy named Gustav Bergmann. And when I applied to graduate school, I applied here and there, and I got a teaching assistantship at the University of Iowa. So, of course, that's where I went, because I had money. Well, guess who the leading light in the philosophy department at the University of Iowa was in 1970? Gustav Bergmann, who had been the youngest member of the group, one of whose products, A.J. Ayer's Language, Truth, and Logic, I had been so taken with just a couple of years earlier. So here was just like history reaching out and touching you almost, you know? It's just so weird. Well, anyway, he was a good guy. I have very fond memories of Bergmann. Well, anyway, so if you ask the A.J. Ayer or any of the logical positivists, what Tom said is absolutely correct. Ethics and a lot of other things so are fall somewhere outside here, you know. One of the ideas that you find in Ayer's book is that ethics, well, ethical propositions are meaningless. And by meaningless, it's not necessarily a pejorative. Well, it sort of is. But what it's meant by that is that ethical propositions don't state anything. They are really just expressions of emotion. This is the emotivist so-called theory of ethics. And Charles Stevenson wrote a book called Ethics in Language, where he worked out the positivist emotive theory of ethics. In other words, if I say murder is wrong, say, I'm just expressing an attitude. I'm not expressing something that we could even argue about, really. It's kind of equivalent to saying murder, boo, or something like that. You know, if I say murder, boo, would you say, well, that's false or true? You know, it doesn't make any sense. It's just an interjection, right? Murder, boo. Well, you know, murder is wrong. Sounds like it's making a statement about something, you know, a statement you can say is true or false, but really it's not. It's really just like saying murder, boo. See? So that's the emotivist theory of ethics, but it's simply a consequence of the very strict way of drawing this circle on the part of the logical positivists. You know, now, of course, our concern here in this class is, of course, one of the other things that's out here is religion, right? I mean, you're not going to be able to sit around and, you know, provide a scientific argument for the existence of God, the immortality of the soul, you know, all the religious doctrines of Christianity, say, freedom of the will, and all these. Oh, it's just metaphysics. That was their general kind of catch-all term for anything that goes outside that circle. Just metaphysics. Metaphysics, in this case, being a pejorative, you know, it's something that we can't know. Why are we bothering to even ask those questions? So, yes, John.
I take it that reason doesn't fit within the circle.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by reason is our thinking things through. I mean, you always say you come to your faith by reason.
Yeah. Well,
so reasoning doesn't.
Got it. They would say, correct reasoning does fall in the circle. The thing is, if you think, Don Ross, if you think that you can come to your faith by reasoning, you are just making a mistake somewhere.
That's what my wife said.
You are just deluding yourself. You're married to a logical positivist.
John, can I go back to the ethics question? Yeah. Like, some people try to tie some ethical, you could vaguely call ethical, back to raw biology and how humans compare to other animals.
Right.
Which I guess is, in a sense, a way to try to drag it into the circle.
Yes.
Is that fair?
That is a true statement. As a matter of fact, I would say that Aristotle goes in that direction. For Aristotle, well, it's even broader than that, but you know, for Aristotle, every natural object has a certain type of behaviors that are specific to that kind of natural object, right? Humans are one of those species, so we have certain behaviors that are natural to human beings. And that's
like caring for your children.
Yes. Yeah. And lots of other things.
Biologically derived, I guess.
A whole slew of things, including our relationships with other people, our altruistic impulses, and the whole deal. You know, it's all kind of biological. So, that would definitely pull it inside the circle, or potentially could, at least, assuming you're reasoning correctly. Yes.
Would you define metaphysics for me?
Okay, you know, of course, the word metaphysics has got a lot of meanings, depending on, you know. But the way the logical positivists, defined it is basically anything outside this circle. They would always precede it by the word just. Oh, it's just metaphysics, you know, as if it's of no account, you know. Now, of course, that's traditionally, I mean, it's got a long history behind it. The word metaphysics just comes from Aristotle. Or maybe I should say it comes from Aristotle's editors. Because Aristotle, you know, Aristotle's works are nothing but a bunch of lecture notes, and when Aristotle's lecture notes were discovered in the library of, I think, Pergamum in the first century BCE, you know, they editors put them together, and they and courses that had a similar subject matter they would combine into the same work. And so one of the works was the physics, which concerned change. But another one, or I should say collection of probably courses, was called the physics concerning change. But there's another whole slew of course material on just being. Not change, but what is it for a thing to be, as opposed to how can a thing change? And then the editors of that, so let's, what are we going to call this? Well, we already got physics here, so let's just call it metaphysica. The treatises that come after the physics, you know. And so the word metaphysics was born. And so originally, it has a very fine connotation. It's simply a study of being, what it is to be, what it is to exist, and to be a kind of a thing, and all that sort of thing. But in the hands of the logical positivist, then it became a pejorative word. And as I say, often preceded by the word just. Oh, it's just metaphysics. In other words, you can ignore it. So in other words, yeah, positivism has got huge implications for religion. Because most of the time, although not all the time, as we'll discover, but most of the time, it's on the outside as opposed to the inside of the circle. But But I'm still answering Tom's question. that's the logical positivists, who are the strictest about the bunch. You know, they wanted to draw that circle as narrowly as possible. The people that we're going to be talking about, who are the ancestors of the logical positivists, Hume and Kant, they wouldn't be drawing the circle as narrowly as the logical positivists. Hume, it would never occur, for example, to Hume and Kant to exclude ethics from the circle. Ethics, I mean, Hume and Kant both wrote about ethics. They both regarded ethics as possible, a possible subject of inquiry right here in the circle. Not everything comes in the circle, but in other words, they simply drew the circle somewhat more widely, somewhat wider, to incorporate more than the logical positivists wanted to incorporate. When you get to William James, however, that circle gets even bigger, and I that's probably why Peirce was so horrified at what James did, that Peirce wanted to rename his whole position pragmaticism after he had committed to the word positivism in his essay, How to Make Our Ideas Clear. James picked up on that word, and then he developed his own views, and Peirce was saying, holy cow, what has he done to my name here? So I'm going to rename my own position pragmaticism, because I don't want to be associated with that guy over there. But anyway, yeah, James wants to draw the circle even wider than Hume and Kant did. So it just depends. That's really, but it certainly has implications for religion. And those implications are serious and need to be taken seriously, I think. Okay? So that's a good question. Other questions? See, we've got lots of time to talk. I mean, heck, any topic that comes up in this class always winds up taking about 6 months longer than I think it will. All right. Well, then, next, let me talk about David Hume. He's our next person. So he's our first philosopher, really, to pick up on the Newtonian ideas, those two ideas. What do you do with my mask? Let's throw it down, so just in case I need it. Oh, here it is. I better. Okay, just crossed my mind. Where was I? Oh, yeah, David Hume. So, Hume is really the first really great philosopher to worry about these questions that are implicit in Newton's hints. Those questions, once again, are how can I specify for any domain of investigation what makes something knowable versus simply guesswork? How can I specify what makes something scientifically knowable for not just mechanics, but any domain of investigation, first of all, and then the other side, the negative side, is what sorts of things then are impossible to know in principle? Right. Those are the two questions. First question, how can I specify for any possible domain of investigation what it takes for it to be knowable? Hume says one of three criteria. There are three possible criteria here. The first two of them he is very clear about. I think it's impossible to be clearer than Hume was. The third criterion, Hume, well, put it this way, I have a better idea of what Hume is saying than Hume does. Now, I'm not being hubristic here, because the reason I say that is, number one, Hume is a pioneer, you know? And isn't it true that a lot of the time pioneers have no idea what they're pioneering, or they're not really very clear on it, because they're the very first ones to have explored this area here, and it's hard to, you know, kind of see what you're doing. It's hard to put yourself outside yourself and see what you're doing in this new area. And then the flip side of it, of course, is, well, golly, you know, here I am, what, 275 or whatever years later. Yeah, I got a lot of hindsight on what Hume was doing, which includes, by the way, some really important secondary scholarly studies of David Hume. This isn't something I've just come up with by myself, you know. This is stuff that is out there in the scholarly world. I will talk in detail about the third criterion where he's not clear on what he's saying. But one of the difficulties surrounding that is just a quirk of personality. Marty's heard me say this before. Hume was a bit vain as a human being. He's a likable guy. You should read his little short autobiography titled My Life. He seems to have been he was very social. He loved, you know, and he never married, but he loved the society of chaste women, I think he said, or something like that. Probably a very enjoyable person to have around. But he also was very clever, and he knew it. which leads him in his writings to sort of enjoys, I think, shocking his readers, or at least his readers of the 18th century. They may not be shocking statements anymore, but in the 18th century, yeah. Which leads him to emphasize his skeptical side quite a bit more than his positive side, especially on this third criterion that I'm going to be talking about after I finish the first two. During the 19th century, Hume was largely regarded as a skeptic, you know? And it wasn't really until, and I have to say, the work of Norman Kemp Smith, when I was at Iowa, actually, I was given an essay that Kemp Smith wrote in, I think, 1905, I think it was, titled Hume's Naturalism. That was, a preliminary study. He eventually came out with a book on Hume. So Kemp Smith was one of the foremost scholars of the early 20th century for early modern philosophy. He wrote a really great book on Kant, too, for example. What Kemp Smith points out is, yeah, there is a positive doctrine there, too, which he calls Hume's naturalism, that you have to pay attention to, even though Hume's skeptical side is emphasized by Hume himself. But as I say, that's because of his personality more than anything else. Well, anyway, we'll get to that one. That's the most complicated idea, but in some ways the most profound. And as I say, he was a pioneer exploring this new area. But I'll leave you in suspense until we finish the first two criteria. Okay? So, the first two criteria for some things being knowledge, as I say, Hume could not possibly be clearer, and is very clear in his own mind what this amounts to. Let me find out.
This is a magic marker that seemed to be
pretty good. So I'll write this nice and big. I hope the Zoomers can read. Let's see. Yeah, that board. I'll write it big. Relations of ideas. Okay.
Don't you need to mute them? I can hear.
I can't. I don't have godlike powers on this. I'm not a. I don't own the. If I say participants.
I know how to do it at my school.
Yeah, but you have to be the owner of the meeting, and there is no mute.
Okay.
See, there's no mute all button there.
Okay.
See.
So sorry.
I'm very used to doing that at Ollie, where I teach.
Okay.
Because I'm just like God in Ollie. I have these godlike powers, but I don't have them here. Oh, well.
Except they don't listen to you.
Well, anyway, so relations of ideas. That's our first criterion. Very clear. Let me do a better job here. There we go. Relations of ideas. What are relations of ideas? Relations of ideas are propositions whose truth or falsity you can determine simply by understanding the meanings of the words in the proposition. They are propositions whose truth or falsity you can determine simply by understanding the meanings of the words in the proposition. Standard Philosophy 101 example. A bachelor is unmarried. You know, you don't have to, if I make that claim, you don't have to say, hold it. I got to go out and do a survey, make sure that all bachelors are unmarried. That would be a waste of time. Because you know, because you understand the meaning of the word bachelor, that a bachelor has to be unmarried. It's like a bachelor is a box, you know, and the various attributes of bachelorness are blocks in the box. So you reach in and you pull out one block, it says male. You reach in another one, you pull out and it says adult, right? Because you can't have a 4-year-old bachelor, right? you pull out another one, it says human, right? You wouldn't call your dog a bachelor or whatever. And you finally pull out another one, it says unmarried, okay? So unmarried then is part of the concept of bachelor. I'm just unpacking the concept, as it were. Concept is just like a box, and I'm pulling out these blocks inside, and sure enough, one of the blocks is labeled unmarried. So it's a relation of ideas. I mean, I think that's really probably a pretty good name for it, right? I got two ideas. I got one idea over here, bachelor. I've got another idea over here that's unmarried, and the proposition, bachelor is unmarried, is simply relating those two ideas together. Seems reasonable to me. And I understand the meaning. I understand that it's true because I understand the meanings of the words, right? And lest you think that all relations of ideas are obviously true in the same way that a bachelor is unmarried is true, that's not correct either, because most positivists would say that this describes, among other things, mathematics. That mathematical propositions are really just relations of ideas, right? Because, you know, you have these definitions. You know, what's a triangle? You know, a three-sided plane figure? What's a circle? You know, all these kind of things, they're all defined for us. And what you do in mathematics, and you can remember taking geometry and how you had to go step by step by step, and every step would be really obvious, or should be, you know, should be intuitively obvious, like a bachelor is unmarried is intuitively obvious. Every step should be intuitive. But by the time you get to the end, that's something that's not something you would say, oh, that's obvious. For example, the sum of the angles of a triangle is equal to two right angles, right? Well, when you look at a triangle, now if I were to say a triangle has three sides, you'd say, well, that's just like a bachelor is unmarried, right? It's obvious. I mean, I see it. Just like that. I see it, you know, intuitively, immediately. But you don't see immediately that the sum of the angles of a triangle has got to be the same as two right angles. You don't see that immediately. Maybe God does, you know, because God's really smart, you know. But we're limited in what we can grasp all at once, right? So you and I, well, we have to then do the step-by-step kind of thing. And finally, at the end of our proof, the sum of the angles of a triangle is indeed equal to two right angles. How about that? So that's informative in the sense that it's not something that we would just immediately know, but we learn something. But it's still a relation of ideas, right? It's still dependent on the various definitions of terms, and then simply following deductive logic from there, and then I crank out at the end this conclusion, the sum of the angles of a triangle is equal to two right angles. So I just use that as an example just to point out that not all relations of ideas are things that you just, boom, see immediately, like the bachelor example. I use that example because it is nice to illustrate it, but there are other, lots and lots and lots of other cases that are much more interesting in the sense that we don't know initially, that see initially that it's true or false, but I can show it through deductive logic. And of course, also, other propositions we understand are false in the same way. If I say there's at least one bachelor out there that's married, you'd say, that doesn't make any sense. You know, how can an unmarried adult male human be married? So I know, because of a relation of ideas, that's a false proposition. So in other words, these criteria cover not just things that we realize are true, but it also covers things that we realize are false. In other words, it's a way of either confirming or disconfirming a certain class of propositions. Some of them we can confirm or disconfirm just conceptually, simply because we understand the meanings of the terms involved. Very important to make that distinction. Okay? Number two, criterion number two.
Now, this doesn't have quite as perfect a way of putting it, I guess, but that's what he calls them, matters of fact.
So he constantly makes this distinction between relations of ideas and matters of fact. What is a matter of fact? Well, a matter of fact is a proposition that's not a relation of ideas, of course, but one that is confirmable or disconfirmable through observation. That's different, right? It's one thing to understand that a proposition is true or false just because you understand the meanings of the words. It's another thing to understand that a proposition is true or false because I observe something or other. So go back to bachelors. Suppose I say all bachelors are less than 100 years old. Okay, well, you know, I don't know if that's true or false, really. I mean, I can examine the meaning of the word bachelor. I can examine the meaning of year and old and 100 and the whole deal. And I still won't know whether that proposition is true or false. But I do very obviously understand what it would take to confirm or disconfirm it, right? You know, I could go out, I had to do this real quick, but I could go out and, you know, survey all male centenarians and ask him one question: have you ever been married? I'm assuming that a widower is not a bachelor. I assume you don't get to be a bachelor again. You know, so
getting into semantics. Well, male is a bachelor.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I'm assuming a bachelor is somebody who's never been married. So, in other words, I go out and I, you know, do this survey. I ask him this one simple question: have you ever been married? And of course, if it comes out as 100%. Yes, comes out 100% yes, then the proposition is true. All bachelors would be less than 100 years old, right? But if at least one says no, then the proposition is false. But you'll notice how that differs then from relations of ideas. The relations of ideas, I understand just in my head, I understand it conceptually because I speak the language and I know what the words mean. But this other case is the case where it's not a relation of ideas, and yet I still have a recourse. I can I can go to, and which is to go out and make an observation to determine whether it's true or false. Now, if you ask the logical positivists, they would say, and the logical positivists would stop here. They would not go on to the third criterion, which I'm going to talk about in a second. They would stop here and they would say, well, yeah, this is great. What this does is it really captures the distinction between the mathematical sciences here and the empirical sciences here. So all sciences having to do with mathematics, calculus, topology, the whole deal, that's all up here. They're simply working out relations of ideas. But the empirical sciences of physics and chemistry and biology, psychology, sociology, anthropology, economics, blah, 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 it keeps on going on and on, linguistics, whatever, they're matters of fact, and they all then depend on observation. Those are two completely different ways of either confirming or disconfirming a given proposition. Okay, so far? That's all fairly straightforward. That's why I love language, truth, and logic, because everything is just, you know, like a binary kind of thing. You know? All the lines are very clear, and this is metaphysics, and this is, you know, mathematical reasoning, this is empirical science, and everything's great. You know? I wish life were that simple.
That's not an IT guy speaking.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. But, you know, things are not as simple as they maybe seem when you're a junior in college. Anyway, so let's go on to the third criterion. This is the tough one. And this is the one, as I said, that Hume himself is not crystal clear on what he wants to say, or what he is saying even. But Norman Kemp Smith is, and so am I. I need my book for this. I don't know if I'll get this far or not. But. Okay. Now, a lot of this third area, I'm not going to put anything on the board just yet. This third area is, just like the other two, it includes a lot of different kinds of things, but Hume's most searching and profound discussion of it is in the context of his analysis of causation. Hume's most important work, his magnum opus, which he wrote, by the way, at the age of 29, well, part of it at 29 and part of it when he was 30, is The Treatise of Human Nature. It's in three books. I think he wrote the first two books when he was 29, book three when he was 30 or something like that. And this is book one we're talking about. In his little autobiography, My Own Life, he complains that the treatise, he says, fell stillborn from the press. He was so disappointed in the sales. Half a dozen, I don't know, 10, 12, I don't know how many, but not many. There weren't many takers. And he thought that this was going to be an earth-shaking contribution to the academic world, this Treatise of Human Nature, and nobody was particularly interested. He blamed it on his writing style. I think that that's incorrect. If I can just digress for a second here. The fact of the matter is, he was so far ahead of his time that the only person that I know of in the 18th century who really saw the importance of what Hume was saying was Kant. So in other words, it takes somebody of Kant's stature to understand the importance of what Hume is saying, at least initially, before it's all digested, you know. It's pretty thoroughly digested 275 years later. But at the time, no. You know. But Kant understood the significance of it. Well, anyway, Hume, since he blamed everything on his writing style, he later published two inquiries, plus something called a dissertation on the passions. So the inquiry concerning human, and these were more popularly written renditions of the same thing. So he thought, well, my problem is the writing style. Let me put out some summaries of what I was saying in a more popular style, so that people will read what I've written. You know, so he wrote the inquiry concerning human understanding, which is a summary of book one of the treatise. He wrote something called Dissertation on the Passions, which is a summary of Book 2, and then Inquiry Concerning the Principles of Morals, which is on Book 3. But we're interested in Book 1 and the Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding. I'm not going to be able to finish this, but that's okay. We'll get as far as we can. We'll pick up next time. I said that Hume's most searching and profound investigation of this third criterion was in the context of his discussion of causation. What is a cause? Well, you know, if I determine that A is the cause of B, what that means is, all things being equal, that's an important qualification, but all things being equal, if I see A, I'll see B. Right? That's what it means. If I see A, then I'll see B. If A occurs, then B will occur. That's what it means for A to be the cause of B. Well, part of that, then, is simply pointing out, as Plato and Aristotle understood, too, that nature is regular. If I see A, I'll see B. If A occurs, B will occur. And then what that in turn implies is that the future will resemble the past. Hume asks the question. This is a really interesting question. How do I know that the future will resemble the past? I certainly expect the future to resemble the past. Nobody's questioning that. But the interesting question is, how do I know that the future will resemble the past? It's not a relation of ideas. I understand the word future, I understand the word resemble, I understand the word past and all that. And there's nothing in that proposition that is like a bachelor is unmarried that tells me, oh, well, obviously it's just a conceptual truth. No, not at all. As a matter of fact, it's very easy for me to imagine the future not resembling the past. I take this magic marker and I keep on dropping it, but I do it 100 times. I can easily imagine that the 101st time it's going to go, you know, or explode, or, you know, the kind of things you see in cartoons. You know, like when Bugs Bunny runs off a big cliff and he keeps running and then he looks down. You know, well, why do we think that's funny? Well, it's because it clearly violates the laws of nature. We understand the future will resemble the past, and you can't just run off a cliff and keep going, right? But in cartoons, you can. Yeah. Well, that means we can easily imagine what it's like for the future not to resemble the past. Therefore, it's not a relation of ideas. Well, then, is it a matter of fact? Well, no. Because, all observations are of the present. There's nothing about any observation. When I perform an observation, a little pop-up window doesn't come up and say, this will happen now forever, or something like that. There's nothing in the observation at all about the future. All observations are about what happens right now. So the proposition the future will resemble the past then is not something I know is a result of observation either. Where does that leave me? It's neither a relation of ideas, nor is it a matter of fact. And yet, we always expect the future resembling the past. And now, you see why I said that Hume is not at all clear about the significance of what he's saying, because he doesn't even have a consistent vocabulary to talk about what we're talking about. He sometimes uses the word custom. He sometimes uses the word habit. He sometimes uses the word belief. He sometimes uses the word feeling. He sometimes uses the word instinct. So as you can see, that's five different words that he uses here and there. If he had had a clear idea of what he was really trying to say, he would have come up with a nice, pithy, technical expression, what he does with relations of ideas and matters of fact. I mean, there's those two expressions he uses over and over and over again. That's his little technical vocabulary. But he doesn't have anything that's equivalent to describe the kind of, it's going to turn out to be knowledge, and we'll see this, the kind of knowledge that the proposition the future will resemble the past is an example of. He has this very varied set of terms to refer to it. Now, if you ask me, the most important of these five terms, and we'll start with this next time. It's too bad we have to quit, but it's always too bad we have to quit. We'll start with this next time. The most important of the five terms is instinct. In both the treatise and the inquiry, he has a chapter titled Of the Reason of Animals, where he points out, and this is very unusual in the 18th century, where he points out that, you know, animals expect the future to resemble the past, don't they? You're darn right they do. Therefore, animals have no concept of relations of ideas or matters of fact. They don't do any reasoning. Therefore, the expectation that the future will resemble the past is something very deep in our neural structure. I'll leave you with that thought because we're out of time.
What were Hume's dates?
1711 to 1776. Okay, see you next week. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you, Don.
Yeah, see ya.
Thank
see you.
You
all. Bye-bye. We were quitting at 10:35. That's 50 minutes. So 9:45 to 10:35, yeah. So Max wants us in there at 10:40, so we just run across and get our stuff and run downstairs.
This is different than the other ones.
Yeah, like, how do you know the song wasn't on?
Well, yeah, that's all
I
those kind of things.
On your, I'm the one that wrote you this morning. I must not be on your.
Oh, yes. I thought you were.
I wrote it.
Oh, good, good.
Because I didn't get any midweek anything.
Yeah. That's. Yeah, you weren't on this.
Okay.
But
I'll add you. The one you forwarded me, at least on my phone, it doesn't show it, the Zoom link, or I would have put my parents on that. But at least on my phone. Maybe if I had been on the computer, it would have.
Because I forwarded you what I sent everybody else. You had the Zoom link.
Yeah. On my phone. I was not on the computer, so maybe I would have had it. Anyway, sorry, I didn't mean to disturb you. No problem. But if you scrolled down, you didn't see it. Not on my phone, but maybe on the computer.
Well, let me know if it's still a problem.
Yeah. And my phone number is wrong. It's hard to.
Oh, really?
A fours and nines look the same.
Okay.
So is a nine. That's okay.
Okay, I see it.
Yeah.
Got it.
Nine.
Okay. I'll fix it. But you'll have to check it next week. Make sure I really fixed it.
I'm so sorry. I forgot to put my email address on there.
Okay, well, yeah, do that so I can keep in touch.
Yeah, do you have a pencil?
Oh.
Yeah, good for you.
Oh, yeah. Where was the pencil that was with the...
piece on the chair. Wait.